All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We are here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is talk and text. 312-981-7200. Also, you can get your request in for Triple Play Thursday, and that's one artist, three songs. Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. Coming up in a little bit, we are going to talk about the best and worst spinoffs in television history. That'll be coming up, and Esmeralda and I are going to play another edition of the pop-up video game. And speaking of television, right now we are going to be joined by Dan Feinberg for his bi-weekly visit. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. We love talking TV with him. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, and we welcome Dan back to the show. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Nick.
How are you?
I'm well. How about you?
Not bad. Not bad. So lots of TV to talk about.
As there always is.
Yes. Let me start out with a show that I watched when I got home from work yesterday morning on my DVR, and it was the pilot and the second episode that they showed back-to-back on NBC of Trial and Error. And I hated it.
Did I try to lower your expectations, Nick?
Yeah, I know. You did. You did. And, I mean, even though I like Lithgow, you know, I love him in every – in fact, there's a lot of really good people in the show. It's got a really good cast. But, man, I did not – I watched both episodes back. I didn't laugh once. Did not laugh once. And the whole – I think I'm done with the Office, Parks and Rec, you know, documentary shaky cam stuff. I think I'm done with it. Maybe if it's done as well as Parks and Rec in The Office, but it's not done well here in this show. First of all, tell everybody what Trial and Error is so they know.
It is sort of a mockumentary version of the true crime series that people have been enjoying in recent years, whether it's The Staircase or The Jinx, or Making a Murderer, and it's basically a comedy about a murderer in a small South Carolina town, and a lawyer from the Northeast, which means he's Jewish, gets brought down to defend the accused murderer, who is a poet played by John Lithgow, and quote-unquote hilarity ensues. I'm going to say that I really did laugh a handful of times, honestly, each episode. And my biggest problem with the show was sort of the waste of it all, the kind of profligate cast of too many people with too much talent to be doing something so inconsistent and that was holding together so poorly. Like, I don't think it's a good show. It's not. And I watched 6 episodes, mm-hmm. and I can tell you that a couple of the later ones are a little bit more consistent. But also a couple of the later ones are probably less funny than the first two. So it's definitely not a show that suddenly finds itself. I like so many of the people in the show. And I don't mind the idea of doing a mockumentary concept if you kind of have a reason. And because of the shows they're parodying here, I think that there at least is a slightly different approach they're taking. But you're right. It has to be done well. It can't just be done in general. And I don't know that they ever figured out how to tell this story here.
I mean, I'm not going to take it off of my DVR because of the people that are involved. But if it doesn't improve, and I'm hearing what you're saying, Dan, and I don't think it's going to improve, I am going to stop watching it. I'll just give it two or three more episodes, possibly. But I was so disappointed, and I just, you know, after the pilot, I was just, you know, sitting on the couch like, man, I'm going to watch another one of these. I hope this one's fun, because I did not laugh once.
I found some of the quirky things that Sherry Shepherd's character, who has basically she goes through the diagnostic psychoanalytic diagnostic book, and she's got all of these strange and potentially weird or real or not real things. Later on, she has foreign accent syndrome, and she has inappropriate emotional responses where she giggles at tragedy. I found some of that vaguely funny. I didn't find it funny in a way where I was like, that's a character. Someone wrote a character, but, you know.
I'll agree with you on that, Dan. I mean, the stuff that she does, you know, was pretty amusing. But again, like you just said, just write a character. I mean, she's just a big bundle of quirks.
And the whole thing is, it's in a small town setting, and it's not in any way a real small town. It doesn't feel like a small town. It feels like a couple cheap shots at South Carolina hillbillies. And sure, that's always hilarious. Everyone loves to laugh at dumb people from the South, but come on, you have to have a little bit more than just that.
You know, and I thought of that while I was watching it, Dan, and the first thing that came into my mind about how, you know, how poorly they treated the people who live in the town and the Southerners who live in the town and stuff, the first thing that came into my mind was how great my cousin Vinny is. And how how my cousin Vinny, which, you know, was about a trial in a town, my cousin Vinny, everybody was on equal ground. You know what I mean? It wasn't like the cliched New Yorker comes in and makes fun of the stupid Southerners. That wasn't the case at all. And it was it was about the differences. It was about being a fish out of water, but it did it in an intellectual way, and it did it in a way where it didn't insult either of the fishes that are out of water.
I think you have to have some affection for the place where you are. You know, while so many of the residents of Pawnee on Parks and Recreation are stupid, evil, negligent bumpkins, but there are also enough residents of Pawnee who are good people going about life in good ways, and it's just a town where it really feels like a representative mix of ridiculous, laughable people and aspirational people and empathetic people. It feels like a real place.
Yep.
And this town on this show feels like a bunch of stereotypes in cutaway shop.
Yeah, agreed. Well, I was very disappointed. I mean, I'll give it another couple shots, but overall, though, not very good. Does anybody know, were there overnight numbers for it? Did anybody watch it?
It's a funny story. The Nielsen measurement system this week has been down the entire week, and so people who do things tangential to what I do have been freaking out every day this week because there have been no ratings. It's kind of the day no pigs would die. It's this weird thing where it's inexplicable, and it shows how beholden the entertainment industry is to this ridiculous, fallible system. And so there have been no ratings this week. No one knows how the finale of This Is Us did. No one knows how Rachel Maddow's stunt with taxes. It's hilarious. So I have no idea how trial and error it is.
Is there a reason? But have they given a reason why the rating system is down?
A glitch in Florida or something was messing up the numbers, and so basically the numbers are all backed up. And you know, there are fail safes and double blinds and whatever. And the numbers will at some point exist. They just had to find a way to resurrect them.
I see. Yeah, you know, and of course,
it's never happened like this for so long.
Of course, it got screwed up. The numbers got screwed up in Florida.
I think it's possible that the reason why I've heard Florida is for people just making that and making general Florida with everything kind of joke. But no, they've had times where it's gone down for a day or two before, but it really has been 4 days, and you can kind of it's like when you're in a place that everyone needs to use the Wi-Fi, and the Wi-Fi goes down, and you can just watch everyone all around you go gradually feral as they realize they can't check their emails.
Right.
That's what it's been like for people to cover the TV industry.
Got it. Okay. Well, that's crazy. Well, you mentioned the finale of This Is Us, a show that I'm way behind on, and I know that you were not a fan of the final episode.
I was not a fan of the final episode. I was really somewhere between annoyed, angry, and just hugely disappointed with the finale. And it's too bad because the two previous episodes had been just really great episodes. The anti-penultimate episode, Memphis, was almost entirely just Sterling K. Brown and Ron Cephas Jones in Memphis. And it was just a beautiful piece of acting between these two great actors who are just getting this wonderful exposure this year on the show, and it's so great. And then the episode after that, everyone was crying, and so all the viewers at home cried. And then the episode that aired last night, and I'm not going to spoil too much of it except for to say it was almost entirely a Jack and Rebecca episode. That's the Milo Ventimiglia character and the Mandy Moore character, and it was just one contrived, unsuccessful scene after another, and it not only didn't feel like a finale, it just felt like a bad episode of television. And it's mid-March, the show won't be back till September. I don't like how this is going to settle in my brain for the next 5 or 6 months. I'm going to go from feeling like this was a good first season of television to, when we talk by September, I'm going to be like, yeah, the first season of This Is Us wasn't all that. It was kind of awful, because that's just the way things get twisted up in your mind. You don't ever want to leave viewers in a sour place, and the This Is Us finale really left me in a sour place.
Wow, that's too bad. I know you can't get into specifics as to why, because you don't want to give anything away. A lot of people haven't seen it yet. But you know, I see posts on my news feeds where people, every single person posts how they cry every episode. They cry on every episode.
And were people doing that with last night's episode or Tuesday's episode whenever things aired, or did they not? Because I'm never entirely sure how much when something goes entirely wrong sort of in my head, if everybody's going to be experiencing it the same way.
I will say this, Dan. It seemed like there were less. Because over the past few weeks, it's like every Tuesday night, people are crying, watching This Is Us and crying. And I didn't get as much, to be honest with you. I didn't get as interesting. I didn't even really notice this until you mentioned it. I didn't get as many this past Tuesday night.
I would say that especially after the two episodes previous, it's possible people just had no more tears left to cry.
Right.
But it's also possible that after two wonderfully manipulative episodes that really did earn all of the tears that they got out of people, they really kind of fell flat on their face.
Okay,
on the finale.
That's too bad. It'll be back in September. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He joins us bi-weekly. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook with The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We got a couple of texts from listeners for Dan, and we'll read some of those. And we got a lot more TV to talk about. But we got to take a break for news here on 720 WGN. All right. Morning, everybody. Hi. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Welcome back. Triple Play Thursday coming up. Get your requests in. 312-981-7200. It's One Artist, Three Songs, Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200. We're going to also talk about, since we're talking about TV right now with Dan Feinberg, after we let Dan go, we're going to talk about spinoffs, TV spinoffs. That'll be coming up as well. And another edition of the pop-up video game between Esmeralda and I. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And please check out our Facebook page. Like us, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Let's welcome Dan Feinberg back. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we're talking more TV. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
Hey, I know that you are contributing to a lot of stuff, including IndieWire, and you talked about you contributed to the best concept episodes on TV ever, and I love what you chose. Well, obviously we've talked about it before, but tell everybody your contributions here.
Well, you're gonna have to remind me, because this one was one where I had like 15 different answers, and I know that I like narrowed it down, and then it was a ridiculous thing where I think that everyone assumed that everyone was gonna choose Hush from Buffy the Vampire Slayer,
mm-hmm.
and then no one chose it.
Oh, is that right?
I don't think so. I know that none of the people who I assumed were all going to choose it ended up choosing it. So which episode did I end up choosing?
Well, the first,
remind me, and I
the first one you picked, the first one you picked was Fish Out of Water, BoJack Horseman.
Ah, of course.
Which is a phenomenal piece of television. And then you go on to talk about the 22 short films about Springfield.
Yes, that was the direction I decided to go, because there were so many great ways to go, and really I probably would have put down Hush if I'd known no one else was going to choose it, because that's a great episode of Buffy. But yes, so I decided to go animated, and I wanted to at least mention Fish Out of Water, which was the best episode of the third season of BoJack Horseman.
Yep.
and probably the best single episode of television.
I would agree with you, with the greatest punchline at the end.
Full of great moments, and really just a wonderful, beautiful piece of storytelling, using all of the possibilities that you have when you use animation, that you have when you have a series in which your main character is a giant talking horse,
right,
et cetera. Just basically using everything that show has at its fingertips, it nailed it. But then I wanted to also mention the 22 short films about a Springfield episode of The Simpsons, which is probably my favorite Simpsons episode ever. It's the one that comes to my mind first whenever anyone throws out that question.
Because yeah,
with 600-plus answers, it's really hard to have a single answer. But that's the one that comes up best for me, because it was really and truly one of the first times that the show simply decided to go off the rails.
Yeah.
Decided that it didn't need to play by any rules. It could be anything it wanted to be. It could tell stories in 50 different ways. So it tells 22 stories. Some of them are 2 seconds long. Some of them are extended, long Shaggy Dog jokes. It takes advantage of a cast of supporting characters who, at the time, you know, some of them were well-known and beloved already, but others of them have become well-known and beloved subsequently, and it just expanded the universe of the show while also being a gimmick joke episode. And that's what the best of the sort of high-concept episodes of a TV show should do, is that it should both be daring as a single piece of storytelling, but also it should be part of the series that it's part of.
It's in 22 short films about Springfield's one of my favorite Simpsons episodes. But my favorite Simpsons episode actually aired yesterday in rerun, and that's Homer's Enemy with Frank Grimes. That's my favorite Simpsons episode of all time.
And you are definitely in good company and loving that episode, but I also know just as many people for whom that is their least favorite episode.
And Dan, by the way, my producer Dan Shagru, hates that episode. It's his least favorite Simpsons episode of all time.
And I totally understand both sentiments. I think I am closer to the loving it side of things.
Yeah.
But
I got to tell you, Dan, I remember the first time watching that episode, the first time I watched it. That ending, as all of Springfield is laughing as they're lowering Grimes' casket into the ground. That's a Homer, and the I just remember my jaw dropping. Did that just really happen? Did all of Springfield just laugh at the death of a guy? I mean, it's just oh my God! And I got to say, Frank Grimes is one of my favorite vocal performances by Azaria. I love what he does with that character.
Because he's so totally and utterly the hero of that episode, and no one cares. No one cares that he's the guy who's trying to do the right thing, whose goals and intentions are utterly noble, and everyone just goes, whatever. He's not part of the world that we can understand. But
right.
Homer is. It's a great episode. To me, it kind of is an episode that's almost an episode of an FX animated comedy like a cable network where you could just go to a dark place and burrow and burrow and burrow.
Yeah.
The Simpsons certainly has done amply and many times before, but I don't know that it's ever done it for an entire episode to that degree either before or since.
And I think that's why I like it so much. But the first one, when I was looking at the concept episodes, the first one that popped into my head, although Fish Out of Water, I believe, is a fantastic choice. The first one that popped into my head was Atlanta with the BET satire from Atlanta.
Absolutely.
That's the first one.
Which would have been another of the five best episodes of television of last year.
Yeah, that was the first one that popped into my head with the concept episodes, very first one. But interesting stuff. All right, let's talk about Feud. This is the Feud Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. And I've seen the first two episodes. Obviously, they've aired, and I'm having a blast with it, Dan. I know you liked it. But you didn't see the entire season, have you?
No, I've seen 5 of the 8 episodes, and the first two I really, really enjoyed. The third one I enjoyed. The fourth one was the only one of the 5 that, to me, was a little bit of a minor letdown. But then the fifth episode is, as I think I've mentioned before, it's the 1963 Oscars.
Right.
Basically, that is what the episode is built around. And that episode is, if you are a fan of just classic Hollywood, if you're a fan of movies of this period, that episode is just utter kibble. It's so totally let's bathe in our love of Hollywood and Hollywood excess. Definitely the first two I liked a ton.
Me too. I'm having a blast with it. And it goes without saying that the two leads are fantastic, but the supporting performances, and you talked about this the last time that you were on, Dan, you know, rattling off the names of the supporting actors in this show, and they're all having it. Judy Davis is so good in it. And And I love the casting of Alfred Molina as Robert Aldridge. I just think that that's fantastic, and he's great in it. Stanley Tucci clearly having a blast. And those flashback moments from 1978 with Kathy Bates and Catherine Zeta-Jones, those are also a lot of fun. It's exactly what you would expect, I think, exactly what you would expect from the mind of Ryan Murphy. And, boy, you know what else I really love about it, Dan? I love the opening credit sequence.
It is a fantastic opening credit sequence.
Yeah.
And it's perhaps a little too bad that the opening credit sequence is so good, because it gets definitely there has been no opening credit sequence in recent years that I've heard people talking about as much. So definitely it's not too bad, but definitely I hope that people are relishing it, but also seeking out the Saul Bass credit sequences that it's playing off of. Because I want everyone to have a full awareness and understanding of the Saul Bass source material before they just go, oh, this is cool and fun and hip.
Yeah. No, I mean, well, I mean, you know, I'm a huge, you know, like Saul Bass is a genius, and I have a Vertigo poster hanging in my hallway that is from, you know, his design, and just great stuff. And in the minute the credits started, I was just like, I had a grin on my face from ear to ear, you know, watching just those opening credits. I think it's great. But everybody is really good in it, and they're having a lot of fun with it. I you know, if you're a fan of old-time Hollywood, and again, you don't know how it's doing in the ratings, right, Dan?
It premiered reasonably well, but it's already been renewed. They're doing Charles and Diana for the second season, and that will either be a good idea or not. Mm-hmm. That's the fun of Ryan Murphy, is that everything he does sounds like it could end up being a disaster, and so I'll just nod and go, okay, sure, let's do it. Definitely this is more in my intellectual wheelhouse than Charles and Diana, but if they cast it well, and I can only assume that if it's Ryan Murphy, they're going to cast it fantastically. Though he has, I believe, already said that it won't be Jessica Lange as Queen Elizabeth, and it won't be Sarah Paulson as Princess Diana. So those things aren't happening.
That was the first thing that popped into my head, Dan, when I heard he was going to do Princess Di. I'm like, well, there's Sarah Paulson's next Emmy.
Oh, he says he's not going to do it, and I believe him. Yeah. And probably it would be a good idea to not do that. On the other hand, who would not watch if that ended up being what it was?
Of course. So. Yeah. You know, you mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and you had a TV critics chat where you talked about The Shield and Buffy the Vampire Slayer on their anniversaries. And talk a little bit about that.
Indeed. Last Friday was the 20th anniversary of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Because you're old, that's how it goes. I went and I dug up my original review of Buffy from the University of Pennsylvania student newspaper circa 1997.
That's awesome.
I had reviewed it after three or four episodes, and I was fairly positive, and I think I was positive in a way that sort of showed the potential of the show, but I think I was also able to see that the show did have flaws in those opening episodes. And boy, are there a lot of typos in that review.
Never go back and look at the stuff you wrote a long time ago, Dan. It's always
the typos. Cause honestly, I usually can go back to things like that. And things like that usually read enough in my voice that I can kind of see what I was doing at the time.
Right.
But boy, would I have liked having an editor, but I suspect at the time that I was my editor and I did a very poor job. And so shame on me for that. But yes. So anyway, Tim Goodman and I, and the Hollywood Reporter, looked back at both Buffy, which celebrated its 20th anniversary on Friday, and The Shield, which celebrated its 15th anniversary on Sunday. Mm. So this is its premiere.
And now, when does The Wire celebrates its 15th anniversary this year too, doesn't it?
Summer, I believe.
In the summer, yeah. Okay.
So yeah, so expect to see plenty more critics chats about that as well.
Yep.
Again, we like to celebrate anniversaries of things. It happens that these two were very well paired, and I'm kind of surprised that Tim and I were the only ones who did both shows. Everybody wrote their tributes to Buffy. There weren't nearly as many tributes to The Shield, and I think that's probably too bad, and I think that reflects the strange memories of the internet, that we can sort of only keep one thing in our minds at a time. But Tim and I, oh, we kept two things in our minds, so we're stars. But yeah, we sort of looked at the two shows in terms of how they kind of redefined images of TV heroism, because Buffy and Vic Mackey are both very different kinds of TV heroes, and also how they redefined where people in our sort of golden age of TV learned to look for quality TV, because it was always a stumbling block for Buffy when it premiered that people just didn't think that the WB was where you looked for quality television. And for the most part, they were very correct about that. And so it had to get over that stigma. And with FX and The Shield, when The Shield premiered, there was just no precedent for what it was on basic cable. And so these two shows are very much pioneers of teaching people that quality TV existed in places that weren't ABC, CBS, Fox, and HBO, basically.
Yeah, it's true. Well, great stuff. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. He talks TV with us every couple of weeks, and he writes for he's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we'll talk more TV right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Right. Morning, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here, 720 WGN. I'm the overnight guy here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. 312-981-7200 for talk and text and your Triple Play Thursday request. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. Let's get back to our conversation about TV with Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
I just wanted to mention I liked your some. I was reading some of your tweets, and I liked this isn't a TV thing, but you said between Get Out and Personal Shopper, it's been a great spring for modern anxiety horror.
It really has been. Those are two really good, really smart, really off-putting movies that are at their heart horror movies, and good on them. I'm glad that not for me, you know, Get Out is a freaking phenomenon.
I haven't seen Personal Shopper. It opens here tomorrow, and I'm going to see it this weekend for sure. And I've grown to love Kristen Stewart. I really have. I mean, I hated the Twilight movies. And I didn't think she was very good in them, and I didn't like her in the Snow White movie. But every other, you know, it's like almost every other choice that she's made, I've enjoyed. And I think it started with Adventureland. I think Adventureland was the one where I was like, oh, okay. And now I love her, and I'm really excited to see Personal Shopper.
She is such an odd phenomenon, and her kind of arc with the popular consciousness and with critics and with Twitter, I mean, with social media, you know, it's really unique. And seeing the various different ups and downs she's had, and seeing her suddenly come out on this other side as this indie, darling who suddenly people revere is so strange.
It is.
Why not? You know, she really obviously does try to do challenging things, and I think Personal Shopper is both challenging and she really has to carry it herself, and if it works, and I thought it works because of her.
That's great. And she was terrific on SNL, too. She did a really great job on SNL earlier this season. And if you mentioned Get Out, I mean, I can't even explain that. I'm so happy for Jordan Peele. It's astonishing that it took till 2017 for a debut black writer and director to make a movie over $100 million. I just find that insane.
But it's insane and difficult to fathom, but it is Hollywood.
Yeah.
So you hear something like that, and I go, okay, well, I can't think of what the alternative would be, and that's just the way Hollywood operates.
Yeah.
Yes, good for him that he was able to leverage what he had as, you know, sort of capital and celebrity, and what it amounted to was a $4.5 million weird ass horror movie.
Yeah.
And for people to have responded in this way, that's just glorious.
I got to tell you, it's so fantastic. One of my favorite things ever now is that my dad, who's 75 years old, and took me to the grindhouses in the Loop here in Chicago to see blaxploitation movies and horror movies when I was growing up. Those are the movies I grew up in watching. And and predominantly African American crowd too. When I would go in the 70s and see Shaft and Dolomite and all those, like at a very young age, my dad was taking me to these movies and horror films and stuff. It's my dad's favorite movie ever, Get Out. Like he's telling everybody he knows that it's the best movie ever. And I'm just so tickled by my dad's reaction to that movie. It reminded me of my childhood. And the crowd that we saw it with was very vocal. And that's the best way to see Get Out. It was great.
No, I am shocked because I really did not. I could not tell from the trailers what audience reactions were going to be. I really thought it was the kind of movie that was going to open. It was going to have sort of a looky-loo curiosity factor. And yep. It might make a little bit of money up front, and that people were going to hate it. They were going to, you know, it was going to fall off 80% in the second week because people just wouldn't know how to process it.
And nobody is stopping seeing it. Everybody is every week.
That's just so great.
I love it. Okay, Peter in Decatur sent a text, Dan, and he says, when Dan is on, it's appointment radio. That's the first thing he says.
Oh.
And then he says, have you seen, and if so, what do you think of When We Rise, which I did not see?
I have seen two of the eight episodes. Mm-hmm. For the people who do not know, it is ABC's gay civil rights miniseries, eight episodes from Dustin Lance Black, who did Milk and other stuff, and a fairly star-studded cast, but I have only seen the first episode, which is the non-star-studded episode. Mm-hmm. Lots of characters are played by the likes of Michael Kenneth Williams and Mary Louise Parker and people like that. But in the first episode, the first 2 hours, which are directed by Gus Van Sant, they're played by less known actors. And I liked it, and I watched it before it had a premiere at a film festival, Palm Springs Film Festival, I think. And ABC specifically said, we're only premiering the first 2 hours, so we'll only review the first 2 hours. So I didn't watch additional hours then. And then there got to be too much TV.
Right.
But the thing I feel more than anything about it is that it's an important thing in 2017 that this is something that's on network television, not on cable, not on HBO, not on Showtime. It's also a sad and perplexing and backwards thing that in 2017 this still feels like something that's so extreme and fresh to see on network television.
Yeah.
It really does. And it's not like, you know, it's very, the stuff I saw felt like it was very much made for network television. It's not as graphic or edgy or confrontational as what you'd see on cable. It's been tempered for a network audience because Dustin Lance Black wanted people to be able to see it. And the ratings, unfortunately, were not great, but I think it will have an audience, a long tail audience of people who will find it, and I will eventually watch the next 6 hours. I just need to find a quiet period when there's no TV.
Got it. And when does it air?
It is done. It had its run because it was just a limited series, and it premiered with two episodes, and then it aired. They just went through it.
They just went through it like a regular miniseries. They went through it through a week.
Yeah, exactly. So it was done. So it was done on March the 3rd, and none of the, you know, the first part, it, you know, it drew between 1.8 million viewers and 3.3 million viewers live, and that's a minuscule audience, unfortunately. Mm. But I do think it's a film that people will be able to show in schools and all of that, and so its value goes far beyond just how many people watch it live. In the same way that ABC figures that it has value that it can get out of American Crime, which premiered its third season this week, and you know, a show that no one watches live, but that people will eventually discover because it's not like anything else on network TV, and it should be honored for that.
Yeah. Okay. We got to take a break and we'll come back and talk more. Dan Feinberg is here. Dan, hang on. We got a break for the news here and more TV talk. And you can follow Dan on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. And we're going to take a break for the news and we'll come back and talk more right after this. All right. Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome back. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. I'm the overnight dude, 2 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. 5 o'clock right after this show is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich and Steve Cochran at 6 o'clock with your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And we're talking TV with Dan Feinberg. And speaking of TV, after we let Dan go here, we are going to open up the phone lines and talk a little bit and reminisce a little bit about some of the best spinoffs. There's a new story about spinoffs that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the best and worst spinoffs of all time. That's coming up. 312-981-7200. And let's welcome Dan back to the show. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. Now, what would you say, in your opinion, what's your favorite spinoff? If you could,
Joey.
Bravo.
God, I'm trying to think of what the good answers are for actual answers. So I'm just going to say The Critic. Let's just say The Critic because that's what I'm supposed to say.
All right.
As a critic, I'm supposed to tell you that's a darn good spinoff of a strange sort that really I wish had aired for 20 years. And it is very sad that The Critic did not get more than the couple seasons it got. What are you going to say your favorite is? Just give me a tease on your favorite.
I would have to probably go with Frasier, because it's as good as Cheers. And I don't know if that's the case with a lot of spinoffs. And technically, as we're going to talk about in a little bit, Dan, Happy Days is a spinoff.
And so it's Mork and Mindy, which was a terrific spinoff of sort of current stuff. We'll talk about this in a couple weeks, I'm sure. Better Call Saul is a great spinoff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So hope someone mentions Better Call Saul. That is an example of a really good standalone spinoff.
Cool. Well, we're going to do that in a little bit. All right, Dan. We got to talk about baskets because it's a biweekly tradition. I love the show, but I adore this season. I absolutely adore it, and I love what Louis Anderson is getting to do here. If he won the Emmy for last season, my God, he's got to be a shoo-in. And what would it be, five episodes in?
Let's see, how many episodes? Five,
six.
Actually...
I think we're six in, yeah.
Sounds right.
Yeah. And what do you think about how Louis Anderson, what they're doing with Louis Anderson in the show?
You don't want to hear this, by the way. We're eight episodes in, and the episode that airs on the 16th, it's the penultimate episode of the season.
No!
Two more episodes to go this season.
Oh,
yeah,
no!
See, I'm ruining everything.
Oh.
No, it's been a great season, and it's been so much a more, like, to some degree, I think it's been a more sort of straightforward and consistent season. It hasn't had the kind of entirely Lynchian episode like the odd road trip episode last season with the rodeo guy,
right
which was probably my favorite episode of last season, just because of how outlandish and weird and strange it was. This season hasn't been like that. It's just told a quiet, beautiful, occasionally hilarious story, and like you say, Louis Anderson has been so good and has been so good the past few weeks in particular. It was surprising enough that the Emmys got it right and gave him the Emmy last year, and so we'll see if they can do that again.
The Denver episode where he goes to Denver is my favorite, might be my favorite episode all time of Baskets. I just thought that it was funny and it was heartbreaking and it was just great. And I love what was happening at home with Martha trying to be his agent or his manager, trying to be Chip's manager. All of that stuff was gold. And I just thought it was just great. And I loved Louis Anderson's stuff. And the final shot at the airport where they hug and then Martha's trying to pull the luggage behind her. And it's just this great final image that I think sums up the show, you know, like in its entirety.
No, Martha sitting down, ordering her first Denver omelet, and being told that the Denver omelet doesn't actually come from Denver, and her sadness at thinking that this experience that she was about to have that was an authentic Denver experience is not, in fact, authentic and real, and that she wasn't doing the thing you're supposed to do in Denver. It was one of the weirdest, crushing moments I think I've ever seen on TV. That you just watch that and you can see her heartbreak about a Denver omelet.
And that's Christine. You said Martha, but it's Christine who orders.
Oops, sorry. Christine.
Yeah, that's okay. But man, oh man, that whole episode just killed me. I just thought it was so great, and that continues to just be just great. Now, you reviewed Iron Fist, and you know they've had success. Netflix has had success with Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage. But you're saying, and I think a lot of people are saying this that I know, not enjoying Iron Fist.
the first six episodes, which were all that were sent to critics, and there are lots of fans out there who are holding out hope that that it will turn out that the critics just got the wrong six episodes or something. But the first six episodes were pretty dismal, and my review was negative, and I think I probably was being gentle on the show. It's a lifeless, relatively action-free dud with a charisma-free leading man and, unfortunately, a really weak and thin secondary cast, including no memorable villain whatsoever. It's just not good, and I think that if this were just a standalone season and it weren't leading into the big crossover, the Defenders series, with all of the characters that they've been building basically this entire Marvel Netflix deal around, I think I would probably stop watching after six. Instead, I'll probably watch the last seven at some point.
Yeah,
because I feel like I have to.
Yeah, I'm not familiar, you know, with the a lot of the comic book universe. I've never read comics. And who is Iron? What is Iron Fist?
Iron Fist, his gimmick is that he was a billionaire kid who through circumstances, in the case of the show, it's a plane crash in the Himalayas. Finds himself in a mystical Himalayan monastery where he's trained by Buddhist monks to become a warrior of some legend and power. If you've seen the trailers, you know that his hand glows and it gives him great magic power of some sort. And he comes back to New York City and tries to reclaim his birthright while also stopping crime in New York City, basically. But he's basically just another billionaire vigilante at the end of the day if you don't do anything interesting with him. And at that point, you know, Marvel already has Iron Man, and then you have, on the DC side, you have Green Arrow, and you have Batman, of course. And it's just such a familiar archetype, and there's so little that's being done smartly and differently, at least in the first six episodes. And, you know, a lot of people on Twitter are really desperate for this not to be as bad as critics have initially said it is. And they're like, well, you've only seen six episodes. You have to give it a whole time to whatever. And six episodes is a lot of my time. That's 6 hours. And if a show is lifeless for 6 hours, I'm not going to feel bad about condemning it off of that 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And also these Marvel Netflix shows, they've all been padded and they've all had problems in the second half of their first season. So if it's already out of story after six episodes, I can't imagine what it's going to be like at 10, 11, 12.
Yeah. Okay. That's too bad. Since we're on Netflix, very happy that they renewed One Day at a Time. And I like your tweet that now you got to figure out how to get Justina Mikado an Emmy nod.
We'll see. I will be very curious as to how Netflix is able to push that show on Emmy viewers, because I think that there are ways that they can do it where it would have a story that Emmy voters would respond to, whether it's, you know, Norman Lear's triumphant return or Rita Moreno or whatever it is. I hope they can do that.
Yeah. By the way, we had a really great visit with Stephen Tobolowsky, and we talked about One Day at a Time. And when he met Norman Lear, he told him that Stephen Tobolowsky told Norman Lear that one of his first experiences when he went out to Hollywood from Texas was going to a taping of the original, because he knew Bonnie Franklin, and going to a taping of the original One Day at a Time. And then Norman Lear goes, well, then you got the part.
Well, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Just say nothing of the fact that he's Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yeah, and he's the best. Staying on Netflix real quick, have you watched the second season of Love?
I have not gotten to it yet. How much have you watched?
I'm three episodes in. It's great.
It's there.
Yeah,
it's on my list.
Yeah, and Gillian Jacob, I adore her so much, and always have, and I always will. And this is like her. This is the best role she's ever had, and she's really great on it. It's very funny, and I'm three episodes in, and so far, just as good as the first season.
I applaud that you being able to do only three episodes, because I think that's my problem with why I can't get to it. I think if I could just approach it like a normal TV series and watch, say, an episode tonight and then another next week, I would get to it.
Yeah. I
have to binge it.
I watched three in one day, and I figured I'd take a little break and go back and watch them a little bit. Another thing is that I always, whenever I really quickly binge watch something, I miss it. You know what I mean? Like, I want it to last a little bit longer. And so, like, I did, like, the Gilmore Girls, I did in just one sitting. I just sat down 6 hours, boom, watched the whole thing. And I went back and watched a couple of, you know, moments in the other episodes again. But I just, as soon as it was over, I was like, well, that's it. So I'm going to let this experience last a little bit longer. So
very mature of you.
Yeah, thank you. All right, you mentioned American Crime season 3. How's that? How's that good? You said it was great, right?
It's very good. It's always a kind of heavy-handed show. It's a ponderous show. It's a show that doesn't let you doubt what it's about. It kind of beats you over the head with it to some degree, but it's also, it's so well acted and so well directed this season. It's partially about sort of the plight of migrant laborers in American farms. It's somewhat about exploitation of laborers, but also young prostitutes, drug addicts, etc. It's a dark show. It's not a happy show. It's a show that really probably makes you feel a little bit depressed about the state of our country, just in case you weren't feeling that way otherwise. But it's so well acted. It's great ensemble, great directors. I strongly recommend it if you're in the mood for such a thing.
Okay, American Crime season 3, which is on ABC. What night does that air? On Sundays?
Sundays now, yes. Okay. Which is odd because Sunday is a night that ABC usually likes ratings and no one watches this show, but it's also a good night for prestige TV. So in case you needed more TV on Sunday, which is, no one did, there's more TV on Sunday.
There's more TV on Sunday, okay. And there's always more TV, and we'll talk about it again in a couple of weeks, Dan. It's always a pleasure. Dan Feinberg, TV critic from The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at TheFineprint, F-I-E-N. Dan, always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good, Nick.
All right, man, take care. There you go. There's Dan Feinberg. Always a blast to have him on talking TV. And we're going to continue to talk about TV, specifically spinoffs, best, worst spinoffs of all time. I have a lot of fun talking about this. It's been a while since we were talking spinoffs, and we're going to jump into that conversation coming up right after the break. And also, Esmeralda and I will play another edition of Pop-Up Video, so you get to hear Esmeralda sing. So that's coming up.